overcast, 43 degrees Racine, 44 Kenosha, 42 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News Time, 8:10. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. We welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. This is our last morning show for a while. We will resume broadcast of the program on Monday, the 5th of January. But we have a brand new interview for today's program that I think you will enjoy. Stay tuned. There is no question but that one of the most dramatic differences in the way our political discourse here in America is carried out is that so much of it is done in the realm of satire, and brilliant satire, courtesy of the likes of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and many, many, many others. And it's also a process, an arena in which many ordinary creative citizens are a part of it. And in some respects, an arena which once was utterly dominated and controlled by mainstream media no longer is. And some of the most important conversation, discussion, debate about some of our most pressing political and social issues is occurring within this framework of satire. And there is a new book out, which is a fascinating and perceptive look at this development, titled, Is Satire Saving Our Nation? Mockery and American Politics, published by Palgrove Macmillan. And one of the two authors of the book is Sophia McLennan, a professor of international affairs and comparative literature at Pennsylvania State University. She is the author of 6 books, and among them, Colbert's America, Satire and Democracy. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak with Professor McLennan about her most recent book, Is Satire Saving Our Nation? Professor McLennan, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
You mentioned at the very top of your book, you and your co-author say, we are essentially making history in that this is a very uncommon collaboration represented in the two of you. Briefly explain that to our listeners. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, well, what it is that I'm a professor, full professor, and my co-author was a media studies undergraduate student. And when we first planned on doing the project, we had met over a common interest in Colbert. She had never actually been a student in one of my classes, and we had just met over coffee and started working together and wrote a couple of blogs for Huffington Post. And from there, I suggested that we really take seriously the idea of doing a book together. It was only later that we found out that it had never, ever happened in the history of our university, and we think possibly almost never in our own nation's history that a faculty member had decided to team up with an undergraduate and write a book side by side as peers.
And a wonderful book it is. You also mentioned very early on, and I just appreciated the frankness with which you said this, this book would not have been possible without Facebook. And, of course, it is so easy to denigrate Facebook and all the drawbacks of those of us who probably do spend a little too much time on it. But you're making a very serious point there about the difference that Facebook made.
Well, you know, absolutely. I thank my friends on Facebook because what do? I have my coffee. I look at Facebook, right, in the morning, and I would invariably see an onion piece or a clip from something or a tweet or something was passed on that I would have missed if I had been just trying to look for it alone. And so what Facebook did, and of course a lot of this goes to the kind of cohort of friends I have, was send me a constant stream of information that was relevant to the book.
One framework which you utilize, and I think this is such a great idea, is that you talk about the 16-day government shutdown, which began in late September 2013, and you contrast that and the discussion about it, the coverage of that, with a similar event back in the mid-1990s, back in the days of then-President Bill Clinton versus then-House Speaker Newt Gingrich. And you are drawing a sharp contrast, not so much between the nuts and bolts of those government shutdowns, but drawing a contrast between how we talked about them and the means by which we could have a national discussion about that and explore just exactly what was going on. How was the world different back in 1995-96 versus the world in which we live today? It's something that I think is so easy for us to take for granted.
Well, you know, and it's also a sign of my age, right? Because I actually can remember both. I mean, that's one of the things that I think happens often today is that because social media and technology changes at such a fast pace, that it's easy to forget that even, you know, in a span of, you know, less than 20 years, the world was radically different. And one of the biggest things that was a huge difference in our recent shutdown was Twitter, right? So Twitter had folks participating on Twitter with a variety of hashtags, right, which just let people's posts kind of come together on a similar issue. And you know, we had government shutdown pickup lines, which were just satirical mocks at, you know, what was happening in the world of D.C. As a consequence of the shutdown. But there were other much more serious hashtags, and there were lots of millennials becoming extremely active through Tumblr accounts and other things like that that we simply didn't have in the Clinton-Gingrich era. I was, you know, I was a millennial myself in the sense that I was a young person during that first shutdown. The best I had was sitting, you know, with my friends and complaining, right? But we didn't have an opportunity to get our voices heard in the same ways that millennials can today. Hmm. And that's a really big difference.
You write at one point, for the first time in U.S. history, the narrative of the shutdown was not controlled by either politicians or by mainstream media. And it's amazing to me how such a new development can nevertheless just seem like our new normal and be something that we don't really reflect upon. I mean, the huge impact that change has had. But I mean, it's just maybe there's something about how it is so pervasive in all of our lives that it's something to which we scarcely give a thought.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's still sort of a, let's say, a bit of almost like a roller coaster in the sense that, look, NPR, the major news stations, these are still places where people are going to turn to more often, right? And you still can't trust. If you go on Twitter or you go on Facebook and somebody posts something, you have to check it, right? I mean, you can't be sure where this person is coming from. There's no necessary quality control. So these things are always, you know, at play. But one of the biggest differences is that, you know, let's say yesterday I woke up and I looked on Pulse, which lets you get sort of the main headlines from a lot of different news sources. And then I, you know, was following the stories there. And then I looked on Twitter and I saw that the top stories there were on, you know, the Peshawar. and the massacre in Pakistan. Well, the mainstream news just hadn't caught up with that. So if I wanted to cover and see what was going on, Twitter was a better place to figure out what the latest news was. And that's another kind of, the timing is another issue that allows social media to kind of get the jump on mainstream media.
Hmm. You make a very important point about what we mean by satire. And the fact that it is very easy to criticize it as something shallow and not substantive. And particularly if we make the mistake of equating satire with negative mockery or cynicism or just poking fun, you suggest that the term really represents something else, and that when we are talking about it and using the term properly, it really has no connotations as some of its critics might suggest.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the big questions that always centers around what, you know, political comedy is and isn't doing is whether it's turning people into cynics or not. And all political comedy, as you point out, is not the same. So if, you know, Jay Leno comes out and makes wisecracks about the president's weight or something, right? That's not satire. That's just mocking comedy. And a lot of the late night comedy is, in fact, that, right? Just, oh, look at these dorks, or can you believe this person's taking a run and then eating a hamburger? That seems stupid. Satire, though, is about trying to remind the public that the narratives they've been getting from the media and politicians may be wrong. And it's about sort of creating that gap between the status quo and asking questions about the status quo. So it often what we're finding is common in our contemporary satire is attacks on the faulty logic that we get. So when people said during the shutdown, well, you know, we have to have the shutdown because the Democrats won't compromise with us, right? And that wasn't actually logical because, in fact, the shutdown had started as sort of an attack to attempt to hold back on Affordable Care, et cetera, that had already been passed and approved and gone through the Supreme Court, et cetera. So if you didn't pay attention, you could think that when the Republicans said, oh, the only reason we still have a shutdown is because the Democrats won't compromise, you would think that might have been true. So the satirists had to keep reminding us, no, that's not the right way to think about the story. And so that, you know, was an incredibly valuable part of our public discourse, and it helps make our democracy stronger.
Hmm. You cite as one example of the satire which was in the air at that moment in time, I think it was maybe a tweet from someone named Judd Legume.
Yes.
So it's this conversation, he suggests, between two people. Can I burn down your house? No. Just the second floor? No. The garage? No. Let's talk about what I can burn down. No. You aren't compromising. And,
yeah.
And just in that little exchange, I mean, whether or not you think that or believe that's perfectly applicable to the standoff in Congress at that moment, I mean, clearly that's Judd Legume's idea, and probably a whole lot of people can identify.
Well, I mean, I think, again, like I said, so often in the kind of spin that we got, it was a problem of compromise. And that's what Judd's picking up on in his tweet. And that tweet was retweeted over 20,000 times. And so, you know, this was something that was definitely getting circulated because people found it not just to be funny, but also insightful, right? So here's the thing. You want to break something that we've built and that everyone agreed on building, and now I don't want you to break it. That doesn't make me someone who doesn't want to compromise, right? So that was, you know, that was an important thing. And you know, Judd works for Think Progress, but we had lots of just what we call citizen satirists. Citizens creating satirical tweets and memes that got, you know, a lot of play and became a very important part of how we understood things.
Hmm. And at one of the first points in the book, when you mention this wonderful term of citizen satirists, you make a point that is really important, I think, which is that these citizen satirists are not just commenting on politics, they are shaping it. How is that possible? I mean, and how is that possible now in a way that it once was not?
Well, you know, this lets us talk about millennials, or sometimes referred to as Generation Y, right, which are the young citizens in this nation. They use a lot more satire as part of their common everyday political discourse than, say, the older generations have. And, you know, what happens is that they have an ability, because they navigate social media so expertly, to, you know, get their ideas out there. Not all of them get them out in the same ways, but, you know, I follow someone on Twitter called Top Conservative Cat, who describes as a Colbert conservative, right? So it's a satirical Twitter account, and that account has 183,000 followers. This is just an average person, not a professional comedian. So this, you know, this is a big deal. So when they go out there and they say something, they have an ability to get that idea communicated, you know, to a significant population. The other side of it, though, is that this is not about satire just meant to say, wow, look at these idiots, like we said before. You know, politicians are stupid. I can't be bothered with it. What we find is that these same people who have these kinds of accounts and who are out there producing citizen satire are also voting. And they're also doing community volunteering. And they're also, you know, trying to help their classmates register to vote. So we've got this extremely active and engaged young millennial generation that, especially the ones that watch shows like The Colbert Report and The Daily Show, that are doing all of it, producing satire, voting, and caring about their nation.
Hmm. I thought it was really important when you talk about kind of the current state of satirical comedy and the influence that it has on the political process, that you mentioned the fact that Jon Stewart, on a relatively recent study of news figures who are most admired, ranked really high on this list, and I mean ahead of other more, you know, shall we say, serious mainstream kind of media figures, although he was not at the very, very top. But just the fact that somebody who is in the business of satire would be so highly admired, and in other polls so highly trusted, although, of course, there's plenty of people who might very much be at odds with Jon Stewart's political bent. But, I mean, just the fact that somebody in the business of comedy, even if it's comedy with a serious purpose, could achieve a really high level of admirability and trustworthiness, that really says something about the place that this has in our national life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that one of the statements we make is that satire is present so often, right, in political discourse that we've come to take it for granted. But it's incredibly strange, as you point out, that Stewart would have even been on that survey as an option, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. He's a comedian. How exactly is he tying with Brian Williams and Anderson Cooper? I mean, it's nuts, right? So there's a lot of things going on, one of which is that the way in which those satire news shows fact check, in fact, has meant that their viewers are getting pretty accurate information. Sure, slanted, sure, geared more towards covering certain kinds of news and not other kinds of news. But the fact is that in study after study after study, viewers of those shows score higher in their knowledge of politics than viewers of just cable news. And so that's fascinating. The other thing is, like, that, you know, we see that satire is just sort of a player, right? An even player. And so you have politicians going on the shows. You have not just, let's say entertainers, right? You have people, you know, announcing their campaigns on The Daily Show. And what was interesting is that when candidates went on the Colbert Report, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, their campaigns got increased contributions. So these were working, right, for the politicians, too, as outlets, right, to get their ideas across. So this is a very new development that, for instance, you almost couldn't run a political campaign today and avoid going on any of those shows.
Hmm. Say a word about, and this is, I know we're just about out of time, but say a word about what is different about this kind of satire beyond its utter pervasiveness, the fact that there is so much of it and that so much of it is done at such a high level. It is not unique, of course, in our history. We've had plenty of figures from Ben Franklin to Mark Twain to all kinds of other names that I don't know off the top of my head, but people who have engaged in sort of this exact same thing. But what is different about this kind of satire, besides the fact that technology allows it to sort of permeate our lives in a way that is truly unprecedented?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of different ones. But one of the key things is to follow up on what we were just talking about. Now, satire doesn't just comment on the news. It actually makes it. And that's a very big difference. And we often find that the morning news shows will cover what had happened on the Daily Show or the Colbert Report the night before. That's a very fascinating flip. The other thing, as we've been discussing, is the accessibility of satire to the citizenry as a whole, so that it's not just about some professionals working and making their living and getting rich off of this. This is something that's really a part of the political fabric, you know, from every corner. And then I think the other side of it that you touched on a bit is that we've got this place where we think that satire is more trustworthy. And there's a lot to say about why people don't trust politicians. I think they've almost never have, right? I mean, that's a common concern in any kind of democracy. But the extent to which people really don't trust the spin. And so the satirists seem to be this much more trustworthy space to think about political issues, because both the politicians and most of the media that cover them seem to just operate in a world of spin.
Mm-hmm. We can explore this in much, much greater detail in this really, really fascinating book called Is Satire Saving Our Nation? Mockery and American Politics. One of the authors, Sophia McLennan. Professor McLennan, thank you so much for writing this really important, entertaining book. And I appreciate the chance to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me on.
The time is 8:32. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's morning show, an interview from the archives. We are off to New England today, at least figuratively speaking, as I speak to the author of a really interesting book called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. Professor Douglas Wynot, who teaches creative writing at Emerson College in Boston, has written a number of books which bring alive certain facets of American life, including A Country Practice, Scenes from a Veterinary Life, and A Unit of Water, A Unit of Time, Joel White's Last Boat, and Following the Bloom, Across America with the Migratory Beekeepers. In The Sugar Season, Professor Wynot is giving us a thorough and wide-ranging view of essentially the maple syrup business, and helps us to encounter and meet and understand those who tap the maple trees, and of what can be done with that wondrous sap, and of how this is an industry which is expanding, becoming global in its scope, accessing new technologies, and yet at the same time holding on to many traditions. And even as it becomes a very global entrepreneurial kind of exploit, it is also in many cases very much family-based, family-rooted. And the clash between old and new practice and mounting concerns about how climate change is altering the potential for the maple industry in the United States. All of that complicates the lives and, in a sense, enhances the drama which we follow in this book published by Da Capo Press, again called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. And Professor Douglas Wynot, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
Really happy to be speaking with you about this.
Nice.
I suspect that as you began this book, you at least had some basic vague notion that it would be more interesting and more complicated than it might appear to be on the surface. Am I right? Or as you undertook this, did you already have a pretty good sense that this would be, in a sense, a complicated story?
I had a sense of the basic story. When we moved to New Hampshire, my wife became an elementary school teacher, and she began taking her third grade class to a sugar house every year to learn about that business and the local economic culture. So when she went there, she took me on the weekend, and it became a ritual for us. We started going to the sugar houses regularly and going to other sugar houses. In 2009, when I heard about the discovery of an invasive insect in Worcester, Massachusetts, called the Asian longhorn beetle, and the cutting down of 20,000 trees, I began to wonder what would happen if that bug got up into New Hampshire and Vermont and got into the maple trees. What would happen to the maple syrup industry? So I called the sugar maker who lives not far from where I live. His name is Bruce Bascom, and he's the largest maple syrup producer in New Hampshire and the largest processor of maple syrup in the United States now. He wasn't when I first called him. And I asked him about this insect, and we talked about it a bit, but he wasn't all that concerned about it. He is concerned, but not all that concerned because the quarantine is fairly effective and the bug moves slowly. But in that conversation, he told me there's a lot more to the maple syrup industry than people realize. And so that seemed very interesting, and I asked if we could talk further. And at the end of that conversation, he told me that his tapping crew was going out into the woods to begin tapping trees, drilling holes in trees for the beginning of the season. And I asked if I could go along and watch. He said, sure, just show up at 7:30 and see what happens. So that began 3 years of research, watching them do their work and following three maple syrup seasons.
Hmm. As I read your book, I was transported back to a time when I was probably in second grade or so, where I was on some sort of school field trip, and although not to New England, certainly, where I got to sort of see this for myself. But I suspect there are all kinds of listeners who've either never seen what you've seen, or if it's been so long, they've completely forgotten. So let's just start with the basics. When one has a grove of maple trees, what does one do with them? And maybe beginning with how it was once done.
Well, in the very beginning, it was done by Native Americans. Indians taught the settlers how to do this. They had primitive methods of scoring trees and draining sap into hollowed out logs and then placing hot rocks in them to boil the sap down until it was at the sugar stage. And they took it in many cases all the way to hard sugar. But they learned from the settlers how to use pots and various kinds of pans to boil with, and the industry progressed on. At the turn of the century, they were making more syrup. They couldn't compete with the white sugar market any longer. And so we get up to Bruce Bascom's father, who was hanging buckets on trees and using horses to haul tanks to gather the syrup and then boiling it. Boiling down 45 gallons of syrup to make a 45 gallons of sap to make a gallon of syrup, and so that way of using buckets to gather sap was the traditional way for many, many years. But the industry declined from the Civil War period down to about 10% of what it was in the 1960s, and that was partly because of labor costs and various other reasons. And during that time, plastic tubing began to be used to transport the sap from the trees to the tanks. And Bruce Bascom graduated from college in 1972. He had gone to the business school at the University of New Hampshire and come back to the farm and decided that plastic tubing was the future, that it was a way to make maple syrup production a commercial venture, a profitable one. So he converted the farm to plastic tubing, and before long they had 25,000 taps on plastic tubing and were the largest producers in New Hampshire. Today he's still the largest producer in New Hampshire and as I said, one of the largest in the country. He made 28,000 gallons of maple syrup last year.
Can you explain what a difference is made by the use of plastic tubing? I mean, is it for the sake of hastening the process or making it more efficient? And why is it that anybody would be resistant to the usage of plastic tubing?
Well, I think they were resistant because of the way that buckets and, you know, the traditional romantic vision of buckets hanging on trees and horse-drawn wagons, the traditional way. And I think that people thought that the use of plastic tubing was going to not only degrade the tradition, but degrade the process and the quality of maple syrup. And that's really not the case. It was more a method of transporting the syrup. It's very difficult to gather buckets make maple syrup that way. There's a labor cost. One person can gather about 500 buckets in a day, and it took seven people a day to gather. It took seven people 2 days to gather 7,000 buckets. So the labor costs were formidable. And maple syrup is an expensive product. There are labor costs and there are a lot of energy costs because it has to be boiled down. So people were resistant to the sight of plastic tubing going up on the trees, and they wondered, where are the buckets, where are the horses? But it allowed the business to be profitable. It revolutionized the maple syrup industry and allowed people to do it as a business.
Hmm. You tell us at one point, Bruce Bascom, he's one of the primary figures whom we follow in your story, you tell us that with the help of a cousin and someone else assembled, he assembled a tubing system that was the largest in New Hampshire. For a while at Bascom's, buckets and tubing coexisted, but gradually the buckets diminished and would only be seen around the sugar house for the benefit of visitors. So in other words, you have tourists who come through and who enjoy seeing the way things were once done. But in fact, that old way of doing things has been largely supplanted by this new technology, which in effect makes this industry profitable again.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a changeover in the generations. Bruce's father, Ken Bascom, was a risk taker and innovator himself. I mean, he sold his dairy herd in 1963 and went into maple syrup production full time. No one had ever done that before where he lived. But he used buckets, and even though he worked 80 hours a week, and worked very hard, he continued to make hay and cut firewood. When Bruce returned from college, they weren't very profitable. And so, you know, he started converting to plastic tubing. So the two generations sort of coexisted for a while. But eventually the buckets were phased out, and as Ken got older and retired. And I mean, I've seen actually two or three buckets hanging on the trees even, lately, a few years ago, just to show them up there.
Mm. One of the things we see in your book, through your eyes, are various sugar houses, and they come in all shapes and sizes, and some were sort of technological marvels, and others were more charming and sort of evoked a different age. Explain to our listeners what essentially happens in the sugar house and what makes a sugar house so often a very intriguing and inviting place to visit.
No, that's wonderful. Bruce has said that from where we are in New Hampshire, now the maple syrup industry is far beyond New England. It's all over the place, but it's a very, very important part of the cultural fabric here. And Bruce has told me that from where he sits, on Mount Kingsbury in Acworth, New Hampshire, you could drive an hour in any direction and there would be 1,000 sugar houses. I haven't come upon thought of any other kind of agriculture that has this architecture, the sugar house, where the sap is boiled. And there are, as you mentioned, there are all sorts of different ways of creating sugar houses, from an old mossy shack to a plumber's dream of steam pipes to boil sap and so on. It just depends on the personality and the skills of the syrup maker. But they are places where people go during this time of year when they're making syrup, and they socialize, they gather, they taste the syrup, they catch up with each other, they talk to each other. And that social part of the process, and bringing the kids to have that wonderful experience of tasting maple syrup fresh off the evaporator, it's an important part of the social fabric here, too. So the sugar houses kind of define the culture, and they define the landscape. It's all connected to that very special flavor of maple in maple syrup. I mean, that flavor of maple is original to North America. It's an iconic flavor. It's the only original flavor that I can think of that comes from North America. And the culture itself and the sugar houses extend from it and are built upon it, this wonderful flavor of maple. And there's also an artificial industry, an $18 billion industry that comes as close as it can to duplicating that flavor of maple without ever using the word maple.
Right. As a matter of fact, I happen to be turned right to that page in your book, 154, where you talk about the huge market for imitation maple syrup. And the fact that there are all kinds of products on the shelves, Log Cabin, Vermont Made, Mrs. Butterworth, and they have no maple syrup in them whatsoever.
No,
so when we go into the grocery store, how apt are we to find real maple syrup on the shelves?
Well, you're likely to find it. You might have to look on a lower shelf for it. But there are fairly good distribution systems, and the Canadians have developed the markets as well in their, the distribution of maple syrup. And you can find it in a lot of the chain stores and in the larger supermarkets. The club stores have it. There's maple syrup there. You just have to look for it. It says pure maple syrup, and that's the key, pure maple syrup, not syrup made out of high fructose corn syrup.
One of the things that's intriguing about your book is how we learn about all kinds of terminology that sometimes evokes sort of other technologies or other products that have absolutely nothing to do with maple syrup or sap from trees. That, for instance, there are various grades that evidently make a real difference in how something is most likely to be used, and that when one talks about the whole industry, that sometimes we're throwing around terms like cartels to describe this explosive industry. Can you just say a quick word about each of those matters?
Well, as far as grades go, that's according to color. When the maple sap comes out of the tree, it's pure sucrose. And as the season progresses, as it gets warmer, as yeasts act upon the sap, those sugars are inverted and changed, and the sugars become a more complex group within the sap, and the mineral content of the sap changes. So as the season progresses, the maple syrup becomes darker. It starts off grade A light, and then it moves to amber, medium amber, and dark amber, and what they call grade B, which is a very dark syrup. People used to say that it was just good for cooking, but these days a lot of people prefer the darker grade B syrup, think it has more flavor. As a matter of fact, I talked to a sugar maker in Putney, Vermont, who had an account with a diner in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he was told by the waitresses that he should bring grade B, that when he served grade B syrup, the waitresses were getting better tips. So they complained.
Right.
As far as the cartel goes, that is referring to the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers. Now, one of the big surprises to me when I was doing this research is that Quebec makes 70% to 80% of the world crop of maple syrup. And they have an agricultural union up there called the Federation. It consists of about 7,500 members. By joining together like that, they are able to set the world price and set a base price, which As a result, has stabilized the industry and allowed sugar makers not only in Quebec to grow and expand, but also in the United States. The United States industry is expanding. Producers are able to get bank loans to put up tubing systems because of the stability of the price. Now, one other reason that it's called a cartel is because the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers also established what they call the Global Strategic Reserve, in which they set aside a huge amount of maple syrup and they store it in warehouses. I think they have 3 warehouses in Quebec. And sometimes this amount is double the total U.S. yearly crop. It's there in the event of a shortage. If the maple syrup production depends upon the weather, the cold nights, the warm days, the freezing and thawing, and that can be a very short season depending on the weather. So if there's a short crop, that surplus is there to be sold to packers and processors in Canada and the United States so that they can meet their orders and put maple syrup on the shelves. Mm. In the old days, it used to be up and down, and it was very hard to establish a stable market, and that's not the case anymore.
I'm glad you touched on the matter of temperature and weather, because, of course, that becomes a very predominant theme, especially as we reach the end of your book, when New England experiences an uncommonly warm spring, which has a very serious adversarial effect on the maple crop for the year. What is it about shifts in temperature that are so essential to a tree producing sap, which can be tapped and then utilized? Why is temperature such an important matter?
Well, that's because of the biology of the maple tree. They produce their sap, and they send their sap with sugar up to their branch tips to make leaves. This time of the year, when it freezes at night and thaws during the day, when you think of it, that's a delicate time of the year when that band of heat is moving northward and spring is happening, and you get temperatures below freezing at night and above freezing during the day. That churning back and forth causes the sap to flow, and that's when maple syrup producers gather their sap. Now, if it's very cold, as it is this year, the season is delayed, and it can be a short season if it suddenly turns warm. Or in the case of what happened in 2012, when we had the warmest March in history, there were 14,000 temperature records that were broken. The season only lasted about 10 days and shut down right in the middle of March, when it should just be getting going strong, because the temperature got up into the 80s and stayed there for, as I said, 10 days. Temperatures at night were in the 50s, and the trees were affected by this too. The sap was coming out of the trees not like that clear liquid, but like jelly. And in a couple of places in northern Vermont, where I talked to sugar makers, the sap was coming out of the trees like cottage cheese. So they shut down around March 19 or 20 for a while, until it got cold in the beginning of April and they started making syrup again. But in most places, that syrup after that point was what they call buddy. The leaves, the trees are starting to form buds, and the taste becomes a little sour.
Mm.
It's a very delicate process, and the trees are sensitive to it.
I remember seeing that word, sensitive, to describe maple trees, and saying something to the effect that this sap to a tree is like blood in our body.
Yeah.
And just like we as human beings are affected by various matters, so too are maple trees sometimes experiencing what you describe at one point as a disruption to their biological clocks.
Yes.
You also describe, I think it's actually an expert you interviewed, describing how New England, in some respects, bears the brunt of certain environmental hazards in the United States. This expert calling New England the tailpipe of the nation. And this might be one reason why there has been some disruption of the maple industry in New England. What's he talking about?
That's Professor Barry Rock from the University of New Hampshire, who has studied trees for all of his life. And he was talking about the fact that 6 major air currents in the United States pass over New England. This was big news to me. And as a result, he said it's a common term. New England is referred to among these scientists as the tailpipe of America. I moved to New Hampshire so that I could hike in the mountains. And he also said that at a certain a zone of elevation between 3,000 and 4,000 feet, I think that is, these contaminants in the air and these air currents are very heavy. So that zone is called, they refer to it as the sewer, the tailpipe in the sewer in New England. So this is new news to me, but I have noticed at times when I've been hiking that my throat sometimes gets sore. And he mentioned and quoted a study from the Harvard Medical School of respiratory problems among hikers at these zones in the mountains of New Hampshire. So that is the case, and it also affects the maple trees. There have been a lot of studies out of the University of New Hampshire among Barrett Rock's group of the leaves of maple trees and also white pines and how they are affected by some of these chemicals and how at times the leaves are being broken down, which affects their ability to convert carbon dioxide into oxygen. Now, that is something that is of concern to maple syrup producers and anyone involved with forestry, but when you think about the tree's role in converting carbon into oxygen, carbon dioxide into oxygen, if that's affected, we have a very serious problem on our hands. I mean, it's a health issue anyway for us here in New England, but a greater issue if contaminants are affecting the leaves of trees.
Mm. In the closing minute or so, I wonder if you could just say a word about the array of wonderful characters you ended up meeting and the openness with which at least most of them sort of allowed you into their lives and into the work that they do. It must have been an extraordinarily exciting and satisfying experience for you as an author.
It really was. I mean, aside from that possible bad news that I was just mentioning, I got to meet Bruce Bascom, who is so knowledgeable and was so open to me talking to him and exploring the woods, but also sent me out to key people throughout the industry and all the people who are connected to his business. I mean, he buys syrup from 4,000 different producers and sells it all over the U.S. and in the world. So he connected me with his mentor, with his buyer in Canada, with his counterpart, David Marvin, who's also a fascinating individual who buys 50% of the syrup in Vermont and markets it as well. He put me in touch with these people made it possible for me to talk to them. So you're right, I had a fantastic array of characters to be informed by and to have conversations with over the course of this story in the United States and in Canada, where they are just as passionate about making maple syrup as they are here.
And we get to meet these folks as we read your book, which is again called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest, published by Dacapo Press. Professor Douglas Wynut, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for writing such a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you so much.
We remind you again that the morning show goes on hiatus because of the holidays until Monday, January 5th. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Cloudy and breezy today with light fog this morning and a 50% chance of light rain through this afternoon. A high of 47 degrees. Cloudy and light rain tonight, low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow, Wednesday, rain in the morning, and we could have 1 to 2 inches of snow Christmas Eve with a high of 37 degrees. Christmas Day should actually be partly sunny, a high of 39 degrees. This is